Welcome, Committee, come to order, please. This is Senate Education Committee, and today is Wednesday, January 29th, 2014, and time is 8:02. And in attendance are myself, Gary Stevens, Chair, Vice Chair, Senator Dunleavy, Senate President Huggins, Senator Gardner, and Senator Stedman. So we have a quorum, conduct business, and we're going to take up Senate Bill 107, having to do with reading for enhanced academic development. So referred to as the READ Act. It is my intention to hear this bill today, take testimony on it, hold the bill for further review. Not my intent to close public testimony on the bill today. So if there are any individuals out there unable to attend today's hearing, there will be additional opportunities to provide public testimony. And, of course, any written testimony is always welcome. So we have the bill before us, and if committee aide Tim Lampkin would come forward to introduce the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. The bill you have in front of you, Senate Bill 107, essentially very closely models legislation. Bless you, Senator. Closely models legislation enacted in 2012 by the Colorado READ Act. Of course, it's not identical, but it is very similar. The central thrust here with this legislation is to recognize a trend that students in K to third grade, if they are not proficient in reading by third grade, as they go on through their academic career, have great difficulty in following successfully with their curriculum and the academic standards that are being presented to them. So this bill essentially sets up a model, a program, to encourage districts and the department to step up their game, so to speak, and help ensure that students are proficient in reading by the third grade. It's not a finished product. There are some changes that we'll be working with the department and districts, but we'll certainly need to change and morph this a bit to better fit Alaska. I thought I would go through the bill with you to help explain what programs it does set up. And initially, in the first section, you'll see that it includes in the school district and school accountability system in our state a requirement that low-performing schools or districts identify in their improvement plans a reading program that would address these K through third grade reading deficiencies. The second section would similarly, in the accountability system, require the department to implement reading assessments for K to third grade students, targeted instructional practices and staff development programs to coincide with their reading program in those low-performing schools. As we go further into this, the department is going to be standing by to go into much greater detail for you to describe what those types of programs would include. Section 3 requires that schools attaches accreditation to their having this type of reading program. Granted, not all schools, in fact, very few, if any, of our elementary schools pursue accreditation, is my understanding. That typically is done at the high school level. But again, that's something that we'll be working with the districts and the department to sort out. Also in Section 3, it requires the department to periodically review the state's reading assessments, instructional practices, staff development programs to make sure they're consistent with industry standards, that they're effective and successful before they adopt these at the state board level. The department would also then annually update and post on its website a list of these approved assessments, instructional practices, staff development programs, and so forth, so that districts would be able to access those resources to help improve their respective K-3 reading program. Section 4 would require that the State Board of Education Early Development adopt, review, and adopt these statewide assessments and instructional practices staff development. Again, so that school districts and schools can maximize their K-3 reading efficiencies. Section 5 sets up the program itself. It would require every district to have a K-3 reading program, and it sets up the requirements of that program. Short of going into great detail about the program, districts would participate in assessments, statewide assessments, to evaluate students. Every year they would identify which students are deficient in their reading, and set up plans, reading plans for those students in conjunction, collaboration with parents. There's definitely a personal involvement component to this program. Students, there is an exemption for students that may have difficulty with the English language in and of itself, or if there's certain disability, they could be exempted, or if they have extended long-term difficulties with this program, there are means for them to be exempted from their reading plan. There's also a requirement that documentation be established for these students, that it follow them in their academic career. There are some teeth in this program that if they do continue to fail or have deficiency in their reading, that is, that the school districts, the schools would work closely with the parents to consider retention policies. That is a big issue, but the parent ultimately would continue to have the veto power, if you will, or make the final call as to whether or not a student should be held back at another grade. Of course, there's going to be a lot of regulations that go behind this bill, but that's a general summary of this program, and at this time I'd like to defer to the Department of Education. We have Deputy Commissioner and Director of Teaching and Learning Support standing by to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Tim. Any questions of Tim at this point? Yes, Senator Gardner.
I have a few. First of all, I believe it's section... Okay, in the first section, are we describing simply what they're calling an RTI, putting it into place for the students who are not reading at grade level?
This is working with response to intervention, most certainly. But again, I'd rather have the department answer that specifically.
It's the same idea.
Certainly.
And then in the next section, when they talk about an approved diagnostic reading assessment, is that approved by the Department of Education or by some other entity? Who's the approving agent?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, it would be reviewed and recommended by the department and ultimately approved by the Board of Education.
Okay, thank you. And if I might, I have a little bit of a question about the accreditation standards that are found on page 3, line 14. Does this apply to all schools, charter schools, standard schools?
It's my understanding, and I'm sure I'll be corrected if I'm wrong, but accreditation is generally optional. It's up to the local district, and so it would be the choice of that respective school to determine if they want to pursue accreditation, and if so, there would be a requirement that they have a reading program in place.
And that would be accredited by whom?
Please go ahead.
Through the chair, there's a national accreditation. I couldn't name it off the top of my head, but it's a national.
Well, at the appropriate time, Mr. Chair, I'd be interested in learning more about that because I'd assume that our public schools are accredited. Maybe they're not.
Well, let's ask the department that. They can certainly answer that question for us.
And let's see. In the section, I guess section 5, is reading, and maybe it's not quite the right place, but is reading deficiency defined as being not at grade level, or does it mean failing to make a year of progress during the year of schooling?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, if you see the very last page, there is a definition that defines, quote, significant reading deficiency as a student that does not meet minimum skill levels for reading competency in the areas of essentially reading, the vernacular there. And those standards are established by the state board.
So that essentially means grade level?
Essentially, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. That's it for now.
Thank you, Senator Gardner. And I think the department might touch on all of those issues if they will. Thank you very much, Tim. And we'll go on to Les Morris, Deputy Commissioner, and see Susan McCauley here as well. Thank you both for being here.
Good morning. For the record, Les Morse, I'm the Deputy Commissioner, Alaska Department of Education.
Susan McCauley, the Director of Teaching and Learning Support.
Senator, would you like me just to walk through issues and then address?
Yeah, it would be great if you would do that. In general, is this something that is needed or not needed? And maybe answer some of the specific questions Senator Gardner had.
Okay. well, let me start by just walking through, and actually there's a couple things I wanted to make sure we hit on, and the first was page 3 around accreditation. And I think within that I can address Senator Gardner's questions. So let me just start off with that the way accreditation works in Alaska is that schools choose to become accredited. There's an association that has a strong Alaska presence on the association, and they determine and recommend to the state board what the accreditation standards should be. A couple of, actually, have just been a year ago, we changed those accreditation standards. We had a regional organization. We still do have a regional organization, but prior to last year, that regional organization had their own set of standards, their own processes, and what they decided to do is work with another organization, which is it's a national organization, but a private entity. It's not connected to a government entity. It's a private organization called...
So regional meaning like Northwest?
It was the Northwest Accreditation Association.
Right.
And so the Northwest Accreditation Association decided to use the processes by an organization called Advance Ed. And Advance Ed has school accreditation standards, district accreditation standards, and rather than having our own system, what the Northwest Association decided to do is to strengthen our system by working with this, actually it's an internationally recognized organization. They work with international schools overseas as well. So they brought that proposal to the state board. The state board, in fact, adopts whatever the rules are around accreditation. So by regulation, we adopted by reference the standards laid out by Advance Ed at the request of the Alaska Committee of the Northwest Accreditation Association. So our standards for accreditation are those of an organization called Advance Ed, and we can provide those to the committee should you want to see those. Schools choose whether they become accredited, and so you more often see secondary schools making that choice, or K-12s, if they're K-12s, than you would necessarily see of any school that has a grade range, K-6 or K-8 or something below that. And the reason for that is oftentimes being accredited opens doors for more scholarships for students when they go on to post-secondary. So there is a real need for high schools to be accredited. There's less of a need if you're just an elementary. And the way that the statute reads is for those schools that meet accreditation standards, the state will accredit them. So I hope that's clear. We then accredit them through the standards adopted, which are Advance Ed standards.
So accreditation is, if you look at the library, make sure the library is adequate. What else would be involved in?
Senator Stevens, it actually gets into those kinds of things. The old system that they had prior to adopting Advance Ed really got into counting things. Do you have enough books? Do you have enough of these things? The standards that are in the Advance Ed system are more around the quality. Do you have leadership that provides instructional leadership? Those kinds of things that aren't just counting the number of things in a school, but
right,
getting at, are you providing the leadership? And it's the standards are not so narrow that it's defining what that must look like. It's just saying, do you have a leadership system in place? And I think that if you want to see those standards, you'd see that there's a lot of choice and flexibility because they work with, again, schools all over the world. So different states, different, obviously, systems have different rules around what that might look like. But it's getting at, as the school provide the quality professional development, quality staff development for teachers, how do they recruit their teachers, those kinds of things.
All right. Senator Gardner.
So do we have any data showing whether accredited schools in Alaska are better schools than unaccredited schools? Do we follow that? And what proportion of our schools are accredited and not accredited? And are they urban, rural, that kind of thing?
We do have data on the schools that are accredited versus those that are not accredited. It would be, we haven't recently looked at performance for accredited schools versus not accredited schools. It would be pretty easy to look at, and we could do that. But we can certainly provide you a list of the schools that are and are not accredited across the state. And that accreditation system also includes private schools. So if a private school went through accreditation, they use the same process, and we have a list of those as well. We do report in our, I think it's our report card to the public that's online every year by January 15th, the number of schools in the state that are accredited. But we can provide specific data which schools those are.
Thank you, and I'd be very interested in the results. I mean, does being an accredited school mean students do better?
If I could follow up on that, Senator Gardner, through the chair, Senator Gardner, the one piece is that the new system that was adopted using the advanced ed standards, I think, gets at more of the quality issues about a school versus just counting things in the school, as I mentioned before. And so last year, actually this year, is really the first year we're going through that accreditation system. So it probably would also be useful for us to be looking at this again within a few years when you have more people who've gone through with the system, which really gets more at quality instruction versus just counting within the school. So we'll look at the data, but I would also caution that it would be useful to look at the data again when more schools have gone through this newer system.
We should look at the data again anyway.
We should.
Thank you. Senator Huggins.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Last, you mentioned grants. I think, as I recall, it's acceptance grants, and the big one in some schools is athletics, if you're coming from an accredited school. And the other variable, in my experience of looking at accreditation over time, was that for the most part in districts, it's based on the principal's initiative, not a system in the district. But correct me if I'm wrong on that.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, I think that's dependent on districts, and maybe you have more to add. In the district I last worked in, which is where we're at, every high school had to be accredited. But it is the initiative of the system in some fashion. The one school that's under the authority of the department and the state board is Mount Edgecombe. Mount Edgecombe for years has not been accredited. The state board said it's time to get accredited. They're going through that process themselves right now. So, and I would also agree that for students, one of the biggest impact is the NCAA scholarship opportunities that exist if you're an accredited school, and there is they're more challenging to get if you come from a school that's not that accreditation. Dr. McCauley, I don't know if you have anything to add.
Simply that I would agree that the accreditation standards really resonate more at the school level than the district level. They are things or conditions that are largely under the influence or control of school leadership. While a district office, for example, could exercise influence on those through district-wide systems, they really dig much deeper than that. They talk literally about the quality of professional development that is occurring during staff meeting time. Things that really the district office is probably not going to exercise direct specific influence over, but a school principal certainly would be.
Thank you. Thanks.
My limited experience at the University of Alaska, accreditation was a very good thing. I mean, it required everyone to be involved, every teacher. Everyone had to be had to pay attention to what's important, and it's good occasionally to have to stop and think about those things. You know, so it seems we're getting a little far removed from the issue at hand, but it's been a fascinating discussion. So please continue.
The issue that we want to bring to the table around this is that we don't know if those standards, so we'd like, we actually, I sent them to the your staff member last night, and we'd like to go through those standards with you to see, are those standards sufficient? And we think this language may dig deeper than what those standards do at a specific level. Well, we think if there's lack of a reading program, that would probably highlighted within those standards, but this may get more at a finer grain detail when those standards weren't. So it's something we'd like to further discuss and explore as you consider any changes to the bill to see if the standards that exist may be sufficient. The only other thing I think I should say about the standards, since we've raised them, is once the State Board adopts those standards, they actually come to the legislature, and this is what occurred, I believe, last session, but it might have been the prior session. I may have the years blurred a little bit. But the once they adopt the standards, they then have to send a letter to the legislature, and I think it goes to the leadership, both of the standing committees as well as the two bodies, and says the State Board has taken this action, and if the legislature wants to reverse it, it's one of those cases where you'd have to introduce legislation to reverse the action within a time frame, and I can't remember if that's a 60-day time frame. So that either occurred last session or the prior session. I don't remember the particular year that occurred. And there hadn't been a change to those standards for some time prior to that. A few other things that I just want to raise that we're having ongoing discussion with both the senator and his staff regarding. On page 5, there's some language there that we've discussed where we're trying to figure out what's the appropriate balance between what the state does and what a district currently does. And I'll draw your attention to line 17. We've looked at some of that language around materials for core content areas, and we're just having discussion there as to is that something we really want the state stepping into, or is that something we want to leave for local districts to do? The same would be true under instructional materials on line 23. And then we've had some conversation regarding coaching services on line 24, whether it's really the intent, and again, at this point, I'd say it's ongoing discussion we're having, whether it's intent that it be coaching services or that the department would put together coaching strategies that a district might choose to put in place that warrant, that put together the best practices when you're doing reading coaching programs.
Thank you. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, through the chair. The items you just mentioned, does that hark to the fact that in the previous conversations we've had with the new standards that have been adopted, that the state on their law can adopt the standards, but the curriculum and approaches remains at a local level?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, that's correct. And under the current law, in terms of what a local board's responsibility is, it lists instructional materials.
So is it your feeling, just looking at the language, that this language would the state would retain, again, some of the curriculum and resources and the approaches, as opposed to at the local level with local control? In other words, currently the curriculum is with the local school district. If this bill is passed the way it's worded, the state would assume some of that curriculum and approach, resources and approach.
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, for reading in this particular area, it might, and as we look at the language, it might be that what the state would be doing is providing a list of evidence-based programs, but I think we would want to get real clear with either the legislation or on the record, is this providing lists of resources, if it stays this way, lists of resources that are evidence-based, or is it actually getting more specific than that? Because I think the important thing from our perspective is we balance that with what is currently in statute under local board controls.
So if I was a school district that was concerned, let's say, with the new standards, was listening to the Common Core meeting that occurred a couple weeks ago, again, I might ask you, I might say, we understand that by law the standards are adopted by the state, but again, the curriculum is supposed to remain in the hands of the local school district.
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, under the current statute, in terms of board authority, that's the way that reads.
Okay.
And it's, I believe the statute is specific around instructional materials is what it specifically mentions.
Thank you.
And Dr. McCauley confirms that.
And just to clarify, certainly not the intention myself as a person who's introducing this to take any curriculum responsibilities away from the district. That's not the intention at all. So I think maybe what It sounds like you were saying, Les, is that if the district has questions or wants assistance, the department could provide it, but not direct curriculum.
Correct, Senator Stevens. We would work with you just on language, or and we've talked a little bit about different language that would allow us to provide technical assistance, but would keep us out of the selection process. And I think technical assistance is obviously appropriate. And if you think about the vast sizes in our districts, there are frankly some districts that need support, need help, and need technical assistance. And so to not have that would probably be also inappropriate when you have school districts that are, you know, well under 50 students, and but others that are close to 50,000. We got to figure out how to support all of those.
Sure. Thank you. Please continue.
So the next item is an issue just about how we use terms in terms of assessments, and we can go deep on this if you want, or we can just mention that we brought up the use of the term diagnostic assessment versus using something either more general or that we get specific but really work on the accuracy of terms. And the issue is that typically what you do is you do what's called a screening assessment of all your students. And some people will call that an interim assessment. We currently, in the current practices, use the term screening. So it's not unlike when I go to the doctor, he does a screening, and if he gets alarmed about something, then he does a diagnostic. So the next step is if a teacher does a screening assessment and they learn, boy, there's a problem with this student's reading, then they do diagnostics. But they only do the diagnostics on the students that they had concerns of after the screening. So again, that's another piece of ongoing discussion of just either generalizing the terms around assessment and leaving that for regulation, or becoming specific using the current practices terms. And to go much deeper in that, if you want, I would turn to Dr. McCauley, but maybe that's enough to say that that's an ongoing discussion we want to have with the sponsor on that.
Right. I think that's a good point.
And then Section 5, I would say, is largely really about districts, and I think you'll hear from districts. So I'm not going to get into much detail on that, other than on page 9, one piece that I would like to just make sure is clear on the record is on line 15. We use the bill uses the term effective or highly effective. And what I would just want to put on the record is that what we'd probably do with that is want to have the flexibility, of course, at the regulation level to define what that means more clearly, because those terms effective, highly effective, they come and go in terms of sometimes with federal legislation or evaluation techniques. So we would be interpreting effective or highly effective as getting a higher level rating of some level on a teacher's evaluation is what we think that would mean. And so we would interpret that, because in fact those terms might not be current terms used within a system depending on federal law changes or things like that. So we just want to be able to define what does effective or highly effective mean within regulation, and I would not see if we could do that, I wouldn't see that the language would be problematic, or that we leave it with some guidance to districts to make some interpretation of what that means. But we'd need some discussion around that on the record so that we're clear on what direction to go. I'll tell you that, Dr. McCauley, is there anything I didn't raise that we wanted to bring up? And then the only thing, just our overall reaction to the bill, the last time it was before the committee, we were talking about another assessment, and one of the things that I did mention is we really need to think about how do we deal with these issues at the earliest grade level. So what I can say about the bill is that I think this is an incredibly important discussion for the legislature to have. I think this is something that we want to work with you on in terms of the discussion. I'm not prepared to comment, you know, is this the absolute right direction? I think it's interesting to hear from districts. But there are some very good and important approaches to reading instruction that are embedded within this legislation. And so the biggest piece is we think it's an important dialogue for policymakers to be having at this level.
Thank you. Yes, Senator.
Thank you, through the chair, and I may have missed this, but several years ago, I believe under Commissioner Sampson, there was a law regarding reading, or there was an attempt at law regarding reading. Is that correct? A reading program?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, under Commissioner Sampson, there were two things that he put forward that I recall, and I worked for him, and I think I remember the two pieces fairly well. One was around teacher certification. He had proposed that every teacher in the system, in terms of recertification, would take a reading course of some sort. That actually did not survive through the regulatory process. It didn't actually go into place. There was a lot of pushback on that. The other piece that he put forward is more of a voluntary component, which he put together an evidence-based reading program with instruction. And that has actually been used by quite a few people in terms of providing instruction up probably till a couple of years ago. And actually, the Alaska Staff Development Network may still use some of the components from that. So in many ways, it still exists, some of the good stuff from that. But that was voluntary, and it was a course that people could take.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Les. Maybe a couple of comments as we're at this point. This is here because of some discussions with the Colorado legislators and how pleased they are with the system they developed, the READ program in Colorado, and how they, many of them, believe it has really improved the reading ability of students in their districts. Certainly no intention of imposing something that others don't want, but could you talk about the issue of are there districts that are already doing this? Are there districts that are not doing this? Obviously, it sounds like some of the smaller districts are probably not, but are there some districts that are already accomplishing the issues that are embedded in this bill?
Chair Stevens, let me touch generally about a couple of things that we've moved forward in the last couple of years that help move this pieces of this forward. And then in terms of digging a little more specifically, I'm going to ask Dr. McCauley to address that. In the last two sessions, we've put forward proposals through the administration to advance work around reading. Two sessions ago is really gaining some support to do some professional development for districts that has turned into a summer institute around reading, and then provide some guidance around reading thing at the earliest levels. We have a program where we share things with preschools called I Am Ready, and it just gives strategies, and it works in conjunction with Best Beginnings. They do some similar pieces. So that was a small budget allocation a couple years ago. Last year, probably a larger piece that's more connected to this at a more significant level is we asked the legislature to fund, and you did so, screening assessments for districts. So this puts that in place, but we do have the funding in the budget to help districts with the funding for screening assessments, and those grants will go out this year, so all the districts will have that component. In terms of some of the other pieces, I'd like Dr. McCauley, if you'd speak to districts and if large and small districts are all doing this or if it's different capacity.
Sure. Senator Stevens, there are larger districts. Their primary reading programs, their K-3 reading programs, do mirror many of the elements in this bill. They have, and of course there's variation district to district, but our larger districts have in place strong response to instruction programs, evidence-based reading materials, screening and diagnostic assessments, and then interventions for students when they're struggling. There is some variation, I think, in terms of across the state in terms of the use of evidence-based programs. The bill clearly speaks to programs that attend to phonemic awareness, phonics, vocabulary, reading fluency, comprehension. Research is very clear about the building blocks that lead toward a child being a good reader. And there is variation across the state in terms of the degree to which districts have adopted materials that are evidence-based materials. There also is variation in terms of the intervention structures that are in place for students, everything from a school schedule that accommodates those interventions to professional development for teachers so that they are matching the intervention to the specific problem that a child is having. That's where those diagnostic assessments come in and are very valuable. So the answer is yes and no. Yes, there are districts that are really have a lot of this. This wouldn't be a heavy lift for them. They're doing a lot of it. And other districts where they would need to, in response to this legislation, change some current practices or shore up some current practices.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Further comments or questions at this point? Senator Huggins.
Linda Moodbell. Is that still around?
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, it is.
Yeah, any districts you're aware of that's practicing Linda Moodbell?
Not at the district-wide level, to my knowledge.
Could you explain what that is?
Well, Linda, I'll put it in context. So we have three children, my wife and I, this is a flashback. We have three children in elementary school. And Mat-Su School District was introducing Linda Moodbell, which is kind of have some of the traits because this was the newest, I won't say it newest, but it was the program that Mat-Su had confidence that would move the bar on reading. So, you know, shortly thereafter, I was on the school board. So I went and sat and listened, and I won't say it was good or bad, but it was the program we had. What the trait I've seen, and unfortunately one of the conclusions I came to, is the person that sponsored Linda Moodbell, that's why I asked if it was still around, when that person left, Linda Moodbell left in the district, if you get my point. The sponsor, the person that was a smart person about Linda Moodbell, when they quit sponsoring it because they moved someplace else, Linda Moodbell went away. So I just say that for what it's worth, because I think that is a little bit symptomatic of some of the challenges we have. And you know, the chairman asked a question that I'll just follow up on, and it was, are we already doing this? And, you know, I mean, to be quite frank, I sort of hang my head. We've been a state for over 50 years, and we're talking about most people that pay attention to education say you got to be able to read by three, and we're here trying to formalize and how you're going to make sure people read by three. I mean, shame on us. I mean, I'm thinking about that. Nobody's done anything wrong, but I would think after 50 years that you'd have to search hard. You know, quite frankly, this bill, which I think is a good concept, I would hope that the answer for the chairman would have been, yes, just formalize what we're already doing, because it's very elementary. And I'll be quiet here in just a moment, but here's a quote that stuck in my mind. I was on the school board. Wasn't in Mat-Su, but I was in a school, large school, and I asked the principal, I said, do you graduate students that can't read? And the answer was, I'm sure we do. I don't know. That sort of surprised me, but it stuck in my brain. I'm sure we do. Whoa. Objectively to the bill, I guess, you know, my concern, and I know this is just a concept, but I would hope, I know everybody reads at their own pace and those kind of good things, but, you know, waiting to the third grade to throw down the gauntlet about what we're going to do is a technique, but, you know, first grade might be better, second grade may be better, so I would just caution us to say that third grade's when we got to do it. That may be right for some students. My assumption, there's a number of students that's not the case. So I like the approach and the fact that we're formalizing something. I would have wished, I would have hoped that this would have been done 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And districts already have it, so it's just a formalization, and I'm not so sure that's the case, but we got to get on with it.
It's surprising to hear when you read that there are people in society that are functioning just like the rest of us who can't read. I mean, it's you'd think that everyone who's an adult out there with a job can read, but it appears that that's not always the case. That there are people struggling. That somewhere along the way, they didn't pick up on that ability and have never since. So I like the idea that that Dr. McCauley suggested that for districts that are already doing it, it's not a heavy lift. But for districts that aren't doing it, it's going to be quite difficult. And I think, particularly as Les mentioned, some of the smaller districts with 50 students, they've got a big job ahead of them. And just to realize, too, this bill is no one's going to rush it. It's not going to be pushed through the system in a hurry. I think it's far from being perfect. It needs to be discussed, and this is a good time to have the discussion, Senator.
Thank you. To the point about third grade being sort of the cutoff, is it true to say, and I'm thinking back to my psychology classes from a long time ago, that there's a developmental change at about age 7, cross-culturally, 7-year-olds are sort of qualitatively different from younger children and kind of joining the older group. We have state law that says kids don't really have to start school until they're 7. And we're not alone in that. A lot of places start at 7. That's when the kids go off with their peers, and the peers become much more important to them than previously. And in my own family, I had a child who was devastated when he started kindergarten and didn't immediately know how to read. In first grade, he was very depressed. In second grade, he cried and didn't want to go to school. And then when he was 8, he learned how to read, and it just kind of, like, his brain was finally able to do that. Is that a fairly common thing? I mean, is that why we say by third grade, because there's a maturational part that happens there?
Through the chair, Senator Gardner, there certainly is a developmental component to learning with young children. And certainly children do not all learn at the same rate according to some imposed calendar that where we say you will be doing this at this time. Good response to instruction structures take that into consideration. There are certainly benchmarks for achievement that indicate along the way that a child is attaining the reading skills that are likely to make that child a strong, independent reader by the end of third grade. And those checks are in place, but there also is appropriately a developmental component where other things are taken into consideration rather than simply, for example, the results a child has on a 3-minute screening assessment. So I think good response to instruction programs consider both quantitative information and qualitative, such as the developmental maturation of a student. The conversation around third grade in reading, what drives that and what makes that pivotal as far as this issue of elementary and children in reading, is that after that point, a curriculum, there's a couple of things. After that point, a curriculum moves from what is typically said is rather than learning to read, reading to learn, where students are increasingly expected to be able to read to attain information in science and social studies. And if they are still struggling with the act of reading, the curriculum is moving in a direction where they are then struggling across the board in content areas because of challenges in reading. There are some sobering statistics regarding third grade reading rates and success later in life that are well established at this point. And I think there is also a good body of research that talks about how difficult it is after third grade to catch a child up, that if these early challenges in reading are attended to early on, they can be and in a relatively prescriptive way. If a child is having trouble with fluency, we work on fluency. If a child is having trouble with decoding consonant, vowel, consonant, E words, we work on decoding. So early on, if the challenge is identified and diagnosed and attended to, can be relatively easy to catch a child up. That kind of snowballs by third grade, and it becomes more challenging both in terms of the complexity of reading and in terms of the curriculum moving now toward this reading to learn in a way where that what is called catch-up growth is much more challenging third grade and after. So the intent is to catch this when it's easy, and prescriptively attend to it in a way that is research-based and lots of evidence that it works, so that child's on grade level, third grade, and then in the reading to learn mode of education from that point on. So it's a bit of a myriad response.
Well, that's fascinating. So what you're saying is that that remedial training after third grade is expensive and difficult and not always successful.
Senator Stevens, and time-consuming, and increasingly then impacts the rest of a child's day, because what becomes the challenge is that is if reading instruction, meaning the instruction that is teaching a child to read, is substituted for other things, the child is then not learning those other things. And so the problem compounds into not just a problem with learning to read, but a problem with the content the child is learning. So the content that a child would otherwise be learning if they weren't then in intervention learning to read. So it becomes more impactful later on to a student's daily school experience if they're not on grade level.
Thank you very much, Senator Dunleavy.
Through the Chair, just a quick question. Historically speaking, when I mean historically speaking, last 20, 25 years, Finland's literacy rate is 100%. And generally speaking, what age do they begin to teach, quote, reading? And reading is complex, right? I mean, we're talking about decoding, we're talking about comprehension. But at what point do the Finns start to teach their kids, quote, how to read?
Through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, at age 7.
Start to teach them how to read.
In Finland, that is their approach, yes.
Thank you. Further questions or discussion? Well, thank you very much. We'll be coming back to this, I'm sure, quite a bit, and the dialogue has begun on it. Let's move ahead to hearing from superintendents. Tim, do we have anybody signed up this time, superintendents? Thank you. We'll begin with, I'm not sure the superintendent is not, but Posey Boggs in Anchorage. Posey?
Oh, hi. Thank you. I'm excited. I didn't realize I'd get to speak. Can you hear me?
Yes, Posey, we hear you loud and clear. Please identify yourself if you would.
Thank you. My name is Posey Boggs. I've raised 4 children in Anchorage who are all adults. I've been involved with literacy reading since the first time, probably at least 20 years outside of the school district. I'm part of Literate Nation Alaska Coalition, the Alaska Dyslexia Association, both nonprofits, and a grassroots movement called Decoding Dyslexia. First, I just want to thank you for giving me hope for our state, putting forth Senate Bill 107. There are a lot of shared values that I have in this bill, and what it has many, many features that I believe will prevent me as a tutor for students who struggle. I hope this kind of a bill can just plain put me out of business. I still get non-reading eighth graders from the school district, and I actually mean that literally. They are bright. They are smart. They can talk to you on many, many, many topics. They simply cannot read. I have my latest student is a non-reading eighth grader, been in Anchorage School District all his life. I have a fifth grader, same thing. So while I completely agree that after third grade it's very difficult to move kids without expense and time, it's worth it. It's absolutely worth it to do because these kids, Alaskan kids, are bright and smart. I just took a quick scan across SB 107, and I am familiar with most of the Colorado READ Act. In fact, one of our Literate Nation board members had a big part in collaborating on that act in Colorado. The one piece that I haven't searched all of the documents in front of you. The one piece that I would love to bolster in HB 107 is going back to teacher certification and teacher preparation as a candidate. There's two things that I would like to see in such a bill. One is that our teachers, when they graduate college, they need to be able to pass a basic reading instruction competency assessment. Such an assessment should have a minimum of about 100 multi-choice questions that cover phonemic awareness, fluency, comprehension, vocabulary, and all of those issues, the big five. But also, we need it to heavily cover the response to intervention. This is very concerning because I have heard that there's some interesting techniques that some teachers think might be scientific. For example, during lunch, having their students watch a Japanese anime movie with subtitles. I'm sorry, there's no science behind that as an intervention. So those kind of things that I hear are concerning me, but a basic reading instruction competency assessment for teachers, the RTI model and data, there's questions that would address that. A very good example, and there's many others, of such a test would be the Massachusetts MTEL, Massachusetts Test English Language, and it's a Foundations of Reading exam. And actually, our content-level teachers need to be able to pass that also. A very specific example would be in, let's say, history or science. A content area teacher is trying to teach vocabulary. If that teacher doesn't understand the concept of phonological memory and understand how it works with a student learning new vocabulary, then a teacher isn't even going to know to think about their student. Does my student in front of me have good phonological memory or not? Phonological memory is simply the ability to repeat accurately a new vocabulary word immediately afterwards. It's very similar to if you give me a telephone number, can I remember it long enough to write it down? If you give me a new vocabulary word like protozoan, if I don't have a phonological memory, I'm not going to remember that how that word sounds. And if you tell it to me only once, I'm not going to remember the definition. And when I see it in writing, I'm not going to recognize it because I can't remember how it sounds, what it looks like. So even content area teachers need to have that depth of foundational knowledge about how reading comes about. The other thing that I'd like to say is that our kindergarten through third grade teachers and our reading specialists need to be able to pass an advanced reading instruction competency exam of at least 100 questions, and they need to pass it at a very competent rate. I can send documents to you that explicitly lay out what I would like to see from Literate Nation. In addition, Literate Nation also has how do you implement, what's the roadmap to implementation of some policies like that. And then I'll just close by saying I wish that I had a chance to look at SB 107 about a month ago, because I would have just danced for joy to actually see this content in a statute. I think it's important that it be a law, because my belief is that laws will outlast administrations and people. And you're exactly right. The Lindemood Bell person in Wasilla, when they're gone out of your district, they're gone. So if it's in a law very, very specifically, then maybe it has a little more longevity. And if I could throw in one more thing, right now I would want to know what our teachers' current knowledge level is. And one way to assess that, I believe, is to have ICER or somebody else go and download the practice MTEL, the Massachusetts Foundational Reading Exam, and do a quick random sample of your K-3 current teachers. Do a random sample of whatever Alaskan new graduates out of our education schools, and see what they know. What do they really know? Do they know what percentage of questions can they answer? I myself am working through the MTEL test myself, and it's a wonderful assessment of my ability to teach non-reading ninth graders that I tend to end up with when I'm teaching privately. And thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Boggs. I appreciate your comments and your experience over the years. Could you just refer, you know, you're talking about an eighth grader who it appears has a reading problem, but has no learning difficulties, can certainly learn to read, but somehow slip through the cracks. Any explanation of how that can happen?
Well, I think it happens all the time. And when you think about our NAEP scores, as 67% are not proficient, then, and you go down to how many are basic, there's a lot of these kids out there. It can happen easily, I believe, in a classroom. Teachers, you know, they work really hard. They do, and I think that it's awesome. But I also truly believe that they have not been given the knowledge to really, in the moment, understand what's going on for reading for kids where reading does not come naturally. One point about HB 107 that I'm not real happy with is it says, if you're a struggler and you have an IEP, I can't quite remember the exact wording, then this law doesn't apparently apply to you. Well, those are the exact kids where this law should apply to them.
Well, thank you very much. We'll look at that very carefully. I appreciate your bringing that issue up. Senator Gardner has a question of you, Ms. Boggs.
Thank you. Very nice to hear from you, Posey. Thank you for coming on. You use the phrase phonological memory, and that's new to me, and your description of it, you know, kind of makes sense. It's like falling into a slot that was ready for it. My question is this something, do you think that's an innate ability, or is it something that comes with practice?
Two things. One is it is an innate ability. We can actually measure that as part of a functional MRI. in real time. And laboratories in Georgetown University and Tufts University have looked at that, and it actually is very well researched in the it's the comprehensive test of phonological processing it's one of Torgerson's tests. It is an innate brain difference as to whether somebody is really good at it or somebody's not so good at it. Phonological memory is actually a little more difficult to remediate than phonemic awareness. Phonemic awareness is easier to measure, and it's easier to remediate. And once you're done, you're done. It's awesome. Phonological memory is much more difficult to mediate, and it's a lot more one-on-one. A wonderful example, I can tell you, I have extremely weak phonological memory. I know a wonderful man, and his last name is Schlereth. Schlereth. I did not grow up with those kind of words in my vocabulary. It literally took me a year of practicing to finally be able to say that word and have it come out, you know, fairly fluently. I still have to rehearse it before I say it. So if you give me a word that I haven't heard before, and it's a complex word, I'm going to have to practice it intensely. Where this comes into play is having a teacher. When a little student has a new word, like ambulance, and they mispronounce it, a lot of times, you know, we just say, oh, so cute, he said amblyon. But a teacher of a young child needs to understand, oh, dear, this child has a phonological memory issue. I need to help that child learn to actually say that word accurately so that they get practice in holding those sounds in that order in their memory.
Very interesting.
Yeah, very interesting. A good example of that we've all heard is probably spaghetti and the variety of ways that kids say it as they're learning. Right?
Very good. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Ms. Boggs. I don't think you have to worry about working yourself out of a job. We appreciate your years of service.
I would be delighted to be out of a job, because then all of our teachers would have this incredible amount of knowledge.
That's a great idea. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's move on to Mr. Boggs, Mike Boggs in Palmer. Mike, are you with us? Mike Boggs in Palmer. I'm sorry. Oh, I'm sorry. I got names. That's a phonological memory is entering into this. It's Posey Boggs and Mike Coons. Mr. Coons in Palmer.
Right. Okay. Because you messed it up the other day when you called me Mr. Boons all the time.
Okay.
The testimony from Mrs. Boggs was just phenomenal. I definitely want to talk about that a little bit later. Senator Huggins' comments were right on the mark, and I really appreciated them. Let me kind of go through this a little bit. I just kind of jotted down some notes. Page 1, lines 13 through 14, and then page 2, lines 1 through 5. The question I have is, reading deficiency by this bill, is that reading deficiency due to physical issues, such as the need for glasses, or is this a teacher determining the child has attention deficit disorder or syndrome, or is this the determination that the teacher is a poor teacher? The physical issue can easily be resolved. Teachers, we have a problem, at least in the lower 48, I haven't heard so much up here, but I'm sure it happens, that should not be determining attention deficit disorder, because the problem that we see in the lower 48 a lot is that these teachers are pushing these kids into Ritalin. When I was a kid, you know, first grade, second grade, third grade, you know, I'm sure that's probably, if that syndrome was even around, somebody would probably try to shove Ritalin down me, because I'm a type A personality. It's kind of like, type A personality really is what you now call ADHD, you know, so that should not ever happen. Because teachers don't have the ability to diagnose a medical condition, which I think is kind of a questionable condition to begin with. As to the teachers, they should be, if it's a teacher issue, then that should be easily resolved as well, unless the NEA gets involved with the union. Page 2, lines 13 to 15, section 2, subparagraph 2A, since the exit exam appears to be repealed, what remaining standards are going to be within those assessments, I guess, is a big question. Lines 19 through 20, what approved assessment practices and staff development? I look for AS 1430-760 through 790. There's nothing found. It just pops at 1430.745, so I've kind of got, like, what are the approved assessments, practices, and staff development? It's kind of a big question in my mind. The main thing I get from this bill and reading it is, one, is identifying students with some form of reading problem. Two, having an approved way of fixing that problem. Section 3A, added paragraph 19, lays out a number of fixes. I do not see teachers working more closely with parents. That's not something I even see in that. And going and kind of and then the other thing is that finding out what the child is interested in, so he or she can get reading material that engages and enjoys and they enjoy reading. If you give me a book that on a topic that I have absolutely no interest in, I'm going to read it, and that's about it. But you give me a book about something I'm interested in, like when I was a kid, I was very interested in cowboys and Indians, so I loved Louis L'Amour. I have a full library of Louis L'Amour. And I would read those things until I'd fall asleep, and I remember many a time I'd have my flashlight underneath my blanket so my mom wouldn't catch me reading, and I loved it. Your staff, that when you're introduced this, he said something that, and I bet you Mrs. Boggs probably cringed when she heard this too. He made the comment about, well, if there's a kid with a problem, they work with their parents, and the parents have a veto on holding the kids back. That's full stop on that one. I have a real problem with that. Because if the child is not meeting the standards for reading, then those other courses that they're taking are going to be affected as well, even at the K through 3. So thus, they're not going to be moving to the next grade, and should not be moving, and that should not be negotiable. If they aren't able, they aren't ready to move from second grade to third grade or third to fourth because they can't read or they can't do the subject matter, then that is a non-negotiable issue if their grades are not passing. I stayed back in the eighth grade because I wanted to, because I was struggling with math. But if I had failed, that would have been it. I would have stayed back no matter what. Lastly, just some comments from the education testimony on accredited schools. If hospitals must meet accreditation so lives are not lost, why aren't all schools accredited so we don't pass on kids who have poor skills and ability to function in society? If K through 8 are not accredited, a wide range of knowledge coming to accredited high schools to those kids then would be coming in at a complete disadvantage. So as things stand right now, I reserve approval on this bill and welcome any questions.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Coons. Appreciate your comments. Question from Senator Gardner. Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question, and I forgot what it was. I'll think about it. Sorry.
Thank you. So even legislators have learning difficulties at times.
Chronological memory. You know?
Yeah, you're not alone, believe me.
No, I remember what it is.
Okay.
We were talking about teachers diagnosing and making recommendations for medications, and I understand that that really has been a problem. But a few years back, maybe 6 years ago, we had proposed legislation, and I can't remember what happened to it, but I do remember the discussion that teachers were not allowed to recommend a particular provider to a family. They could say, I believe your child has a problem and should get a good quality assessment, identification, but they couldn't say, go to Dr. So-and-so, or, you know, your child needs to be on Ritalin, that they are prohibited. Does anybody else remember that or know what's happened? And maybe somebody from DED can tell me if it's in statute. It may just have died along the way, but I do recall the discussions.
It passed. It had to do with if you're in an instructional capacity, if you work for the school district, you can't be recommending this, recommending that, making a diagnosis.
Exactly.
That's externally done.
You only can recommend that the family look into it.
Correct.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Gardner. Sir Huggins, do you have an additional comment?
No, I was just working on the chronological memory factor, but Senator Gardner landed on her feet.
Right. Okay, thanks so much. Any further comments anyone has, either on the Internet or in the room? If not, we're going to stop a little early. This has been a fascinating discussion. Senator, please go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Boggs was impressive. Everybody hears different things. What I heard, because it's sort of statistically falls in line with what I think I've learned over time, is the number of young people that go through our system that can't read and get a high school diploma is much, much larger than some people want to talk about. And, I'm one of those that's not shy about talking about, you know, what my weaknesses are or what a system's weaknesses in this are, because we've been a state for 50 years. It's time for us to get on with it.
A very good point, and her comment also that in the bill it says that if a child is struggling with the IEP, that this law doesn't apply, and her point was that that's exactly the person it should apply to, so we'll look at that more carefully as well. So as I say, this is a bill in progress, one that is far from being complete, but I think we see the success that other communities have had in doing this, and we certainly have districts that are already doing it, no question about it, but there are others that are not. So the discussion will continue. Senator Gardner.
Thank you. I have a question, and maybe Dr. McCauley is the person to answer it, and that is, aside from a child who's maybe severely mentally retarded or who has an organic brain injury or mental illness or something, do you think that there are children who simply cannot be taught to learn to read?
Thank you, Dr. McCauley, for coming up and being here.
Sure. For the record, Susan McCauley, Director of Teaching and Learning Support. I want to be careful with my answer, not overstep my area of expertise. My experience and what I know is indicated in research is that different methods work differently with different children, but the research is very strong that a systematic, skill-based approach to reading is successful with most children. And where things don't happen is that early identification of children who are struggling, diagnosing of exactly what the problem is, and then prescriptive application of a targeted intervention that when those systems aren't in place, that contributes largely to children not being able to read. So my experience, what research says, and my belief is that most children can effectively learn to read when there are systems in place where that is attended to early on with focus and in an evidence-based, research-based way, most children learn to read.
Thank you.
And while you're there, we'll take advantage of your being here and your experience. Were you at all surprised to hear Ms. Boggs say that she had an eighth grade student in the Anchorage School District, the biggest school district in the state, an eighth grade student that needed assistance in reading and had no problem, not a major issue that would keep them from reading, but had simply fallen through the cracks along the way?
Senator Stevens, what we don't know are what the variables are that contributed to that situation. We don't know, and there are things we have influence over, largely, admittedly, control over as educators, and we need to exercise those responsibilities. We don't know whether there was a history of changing schools, of we don't know a lot of things that may have contributed. So I don't know that I would say that I'm surprised or not. That certainly is, that at that age, clearly an inability to read is going to significantly interfere with that child's daily education. Their ability to learn at that point would be significantly compromised by their inability to read.
Well, thank you for your answer. Unfair question to ask, but thank you very much. All right, we'll be coming back to this, and at this point, we're adjourned.